It's Monday, November 18th, 2013, and this is episode 43 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. As usual, I'm joined by my co-host, Mr. Andrew Callett.
Good evening, everyone. How's it going tonight?
Goes well, thank you. So, as usual, the thoughts and opinions we express on this podcast are ours and do not represent those of our employers. So, as I've been doing the past couple shows, I wanted to tell everybody about a couple more conversations I had with my friend Bob. And, you know, he had two things he wanted me to pass along. Number one was, if you have an ERP system or ERP application running on a Windows platform in particular, don't expose it to the internet, you know, with no firewall. It's really a recipe for disaster. And hopefully I don't really have to explain that anymore. But the other thing he wanted to pass on was that crack.com got, well, cracked and was hosting the nuclear exploit kit.
Oh, my.
And, you know, cracked is one of the top 500 Alexa sites on the internet.
Wow.
So, you know, that's kind of big. And it was serving a Trojan, so.
That's funny. And in related news, a friend of mine happened to post this on Facebook, so take it with a grain of salt, that she was writing some articles for crack.com, and to cite her material as proofs, she was using books and citing, you know, the typical publication information that you do for a paper. And according to her, crack.com said, we can't verify this because it's not an internet link. Therefore, we can't authenticate your story. We won't let you publish it. So apparently, crack.com will only allow you to use internet links as valid proof of sufficient knowledge and, you know, factual information, not books.
Wow. That's pretty serious. So you basically have to write a Wikipedia article about yourself.
Not just about yourself. Like, you know, let's say you're writing an article on, I don't know, Crack likes to do top five lists. So, you know, the top five worst ways to die in Brazil, right? And okay. You linked to a book that they wouldn't accept that. You would have to link to an online article or some online source, which seems, you know, counterintuitive to me.
Well, that's pretty meta of them, right? So anyway, you know, I think this is an important cautionary tale. It's something that I've talked about endlessly on this podcast and in other venues. You know, the internet's a dangerous place, and even if you go to a site that is believed to be otherwise reputable, there's really no assurance. And you know, if you're going to crack.com with a computer that you use to manage your company's bank account or, you know, some really sensitive system, it's probably a bad thing. Don't do
it. I think the lesson is assume all sites are hostile to proven otherwise.
Absolutely. All right. So let's move on to stories. The first thing we're going to talk about tonight is the release of PCI 3. And I think the standard, as I recall, was released on November 7th, and it's kind of been expected for quite some time. And there's a fair number of changes, and I would say a fair amount of criticism about the release. You know, from what I can tell, and I haven't read all 112 awesome pages of the new PCI 3.
Slacker.
I know. It's like I have other stuff going on. But the the summary from the PCI Council is that they're focusing on education and awareness, flexibility in meeting requirements, and at the same time, more rigorous testing. So basically, they allegedly are affording regulated entities some ability to meet different requirements in different ways, but at the same time, they're going to raise the bar on your requirement to test it, and then also shared responsibility. And what my interpretation of that requirement is that you, as a PCI compliant entity, have to contract or write into a contract with your vendors that the vendors are in turn obligated where we're responsible. And by the way, that to me smells very close to what HIPAA is like now.
Yeah.
And their business associate agreements.
Which, you know, it makes some sense, right? You're still looking for the weakest link in the chain.
Absolutely.
By the way, did we put out the caveat that everything we're saying is not in any way representative of our employers and purely our own? Because I have some things to say.
Go ahead. Go for it.
Well, just at a general level, right? You know, and full disclosure, you know, I work for a company that does a lot of PCI work. So, you know, just full disclosure. PCI is an important thing that companies need to care about, but I have seen so many companies that are fully PCI compliant and still have massive security holes, and vice versa. I've seen folks that are not PCI compliant who are very secure. So, you know, it is a necessary evil, but it is not the end all and be all of information security for cardholder information.
But how could that be?
I know. It's shocking. It's stunning. Well, I think when you try to do a one-size-fits-all approach, you're always going to have some issues. I like that it's a minimum set of baselines, and I like that it gives some guidance. This article here that we got from bankinfosecurity.com by Tracy Kitten. Is that a real name? Tracy Kitten. All right, then. I'm sure she's fun at parties. You know, points out some interesting points about what's missing. You know, there's lack of enforcement, which I think is very true. Although at the end of the day, keep in mind, this is all for the cardholder, you know, the card issuers to minimize their risk. Because right. Who gets slammed when cards are stolen? That is the card issuers. So at the end of the day, if they're not enforcing, it's really their own damn problem. They're the ones who are going to experience higher fraud and higher shrink. So, you know, it's kind of up to them, but it is somewhat inconsistent, and it is somewhat, you know, sort of ad hoc as to who they choose to enforce and, you know, what sort of enforcement mechanisms they have applied.
Well, that's a good point, and I think she points out in the article that especially in the lower tier, smaller players, it's often more economical just to pay a fine and be out of compliance than actually to do what's required. And she also points out that there's some industry verticals like healthcare that appear to just be oblivious to the requirements. And I'm not going to claim to be an expert in PCI. I work in a lot of regulated areas, but PCI is not one of them. I don't understand how a large healthcare company that does any volume of credit card processing has managed to escape PCI.
Well, in essence, depending on what level of volume and other factors, you have different levels of assessment. And at a certain level, at the highest levels, right, you have to use a third party and you have to have a QSA. But at smaller, lower levels, you do self-assessments. You self-certify. You basically, it's on the honor system. At the end of the day, it's really on the card issuers to decide if they want to come after you, right? And the card sort of merchants that are doing the work. It's up to them, because, you know, the worst case scenario here is they take away your ability to process credit cards, right? And so if you're processing credit cards and everything's working, why should you care? Well, eventually you might.
Well, that's a fair point.
I am not a PCI expert, to be clear, but I work with PCI experts, and I've picked up a few things watching them. And it is one of those things that sometimes it's a cost of doing business to make sure that you are PCI compliant. But it is a messy, weird reg. I do like it better than like Sarbanes-Oxley because it actually has specific criteria that are measurable and objective, whereas Sarbanes-Oxley is much more sort of, just random stuff that we often joke is a jobs program for consultants because it's purely interpretive. But anyway, I'm just sort of rambling on about PCI here now.
Well, I think that's a really common complaint about PCI, but I think for every complaint I hear about PCI, I hear an equal number about other regulations like HIPAA and SOX and FFIEC and others, which are very high level and fluffy, and I see quite a few people complain about those not being specific and not really knowing where you stand relative to the requirements because they are non-specific. So it's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't approach for these regulatory bodies.
Yeah. So I think the takeaway is, version 3.0 is coming out and we should start coming up to speed on them. They're going to need to be enforced or in place by the beginning of 2015. So you've got pretty much all of 2014 to get ready for them. And, it's on us as security practitioners to know and understand the differences.
Absolutely. All right, let's move on. The next story is about a report. And this report is from a company called ThreatTrack Security. And the title is Malware Analysts Have the Tools to Defend Against Cyber Attacks, But Challenges Remain. There's a couple of interesting statistics in this report that I wanted to talk about. The first and most important in my mind is, and keep in mind that this was generated by interviewing, I think, 200, quote, malware analysts in the private sector. And the statistic here is that 43% of malware analysts say they did not disclose a particular breach during, the past year or whatever. And I think that's kind of posited as a surprising thing. And I'll tell you what is missing from this, because it does seem like a kind of a shocking thing that almost half of these malware analysts would say that their organizations detected a breach and didn't report it. But having been on the other side of this, I can tell you there's a lot of context behind these kinds of things, and it's sometimes opaque, I would say, to the level of person, at a malware analyst, right? These kinds of decisions sometimes happen, higher up in the organization in the legal food chain. And, while it may be true they didn't disclose, the reasons for that might not be apparent. For instance, you might not be obligated to, and companies who aren't obligated to, I'm sorry, they're not going to disclose, right? That's just the way it is.
Yeah, and it comes back to a couple things. If half are saying that their company, has failed to disclose a breach, I'd say the other half probably are lying. And then I would say, what constitutes a breach that needs to be disclosed if there isn't certain regulatory bodies exposing, that cover that. So there's a lot of things that, these things are, it's a very fluffy, that's our term of the evening, apparently, fluffy, loose thing to talk about breach disclosure.
Definitely so. And I think that's my big beef with this. And I think kind of the theme for the next couple of topics is, statistics are hard relative to this kind of thing. And in simply surveying people about something like this doesn't really portray the situation very accurately. So I think we have to take this sort of a report with a grain of salt. But I think, it does point out that this happens, but I don't think we should make the assumption that it's happening for nefarious or neglectful purposes, at least all the time. I'm sure that there are some unscrupulous companies out there, but you know, I think there are a lot of ethical people who would do the right thing.
Sure, you know, but at the end of the day, it's you know, it's almost a legal decision. To disclose could Absolutely. Cause you some pain, right? And there's yeah. not necessarily an upside, and you know, that becomes not necessarily an ethical decision or a moral decision, as it's a business decision. You know, and that's probably not made by security practitioners. That's probably made by somebody at the CXO level.
Yeah, absolutely. The next interesting statistic I thought was that 38% of these analysts say that malware defense is easier than last year.
I was stunned by this stat.
Yeah, you know, again, it doesn't have a lot of context. And so is it easier because they have had less malware to deal with? Is it easier because the kinds of malware they are seeing is simpler? Is it easier because they're now more experienced? You know, what exactly was the reason? Is it easier because they have FireEye now? You know what?
Right. Well, you know, the rest of the stats are interesting too, right? So 38% say easier, 35% say same level, and 27% say more difficult.
Right.
So that's an interesting stat that I would question in a couple of ways. One is, if that is legit, that it's truly easier, I would think that, A, it's probably because they've gotten more tools on the market and there's more things out there and they're maturing. There's probably more awareness and knowledge being built around how to respond to malware. But at the same time, I would say, if it's easier, does that mean that they're missing things? Is the malware getting more stealthy? Are they not finding it?
That's a great point.
I don't know. It's, you know, how do you prove an unknown, right? It's, you know, there's known knowns and known unknowns and unknown unknowns, right? And so, I don't know. That's a good question.
You're next in line for the Secretary of Defense there with that line.
Well, you know, they call me occasionally. And
but, you know, and I guess another possibility is that one of the other stats is that 84% reported having the tools to fight malware, and only 16% said they don't. And so
I call BS on that stat. There's no way that I have, look, in all the organizations I have met and talked to, the guys on the ground never have all the tools they need and never have the budget they need, ever. Ever.
And you know, there you have it. I think that's a great point, and why things like this need to be taken with a grain of salt.
So I'm not sure who's answering this, right? You know, if this is being answered by the CIO, you know, maybe he has a different opinion on if they have the tools to fight it or not. But if you're the malware analyst or incident response guy on the street, there's no way.
Yep. Well, there were two other, actually three other stats that I thought were really very interesting. 56% say they have cleaned an executive's PC from a phishing email or a phishing attachment. You know, there where a executive, you know, stumbled upon something and got himself owned. So 56% report cleaning an exec's PC from that. 47% report cleaning a executive's PC as a result from visiting a porn site.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. And then 45% from letting a family member use the computer, which in turn resulted in getting compromised. And, you know, I think those stats really point to a failure of a security policy and just a failure of governance, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, to be clear, there's also a cultural issue here where executives don't think the rules necessarily always apply to them.
Yeah, good point.
And, you know, that's not a class statement or, I wish I was an executive. It's purely reality, right? These guys don't necessarily follow all the rules that they set forth for the rest of the organization, especially on the security front. And I think that is a problem, an actual quantifiable problem for security, because they're the biggest targets, right? They're the ones who should be most secure and most, paranoid about getting owned.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. There have been a few recent studies about the vulnerability of particularly CEO level people falling for phishing emails, and I want to say it was a really high percentage. And the other statistic I remember from a study was that a lot of people dramatically overestimate their ability to detect phishing emails, and I suspect. Sure. You know, the same is true at that level. So either they are completely ignorant of the threat, or they feel like they would be able to detect it and, you know, for whatever reason, they're immune to the threat. And clearly that's not the case.
I would agree.
So keeping on with statistics, I've talked quite a lot about, you know, my interest in quantifying the risk behind security. There was a paper put out by this group called the East-West Institute, who I will admit I have never heard of before. And so apparently they're a think tank that is composed of lots of different industry people, and they put their heads together and came up with a report, which they call Measuring the Cybersecurity Problem, or MCP. Yeah, I think it should be MCSP, but hey, I'm pedantic like that. So the net of this is that there are a lot of problems that stem from our inability as an industry to actually quantify the severity and depth and whatnot of IT security problems and all of the things that come along with that. And so they propose this solution. And the solution from a high level is to create some kind of independent entity to collect metrics to encourage companies and organizations around the world to contribute metrics to this independent entity. And then third, to have some experts, I guess, in data analysis and statistics and whatnot, actually analyze that data and publish it. And I think that makes a lot of sense. And they go through a lot of analysis and they do a gap analysis on quite a few existing solutions, right? So they look at the different certs and things like that. And one thing that really bothered me was that they didn't look at Verisk at all. And I guess they didn't look at Verisk because of its affiliation with Verizon. I'm not really sure, but, you know, be that as it may, right? That's like, you know, 98% of the way there. I actually had a discussion with this about this with Wade Baker, who is one of the guys that put together the Verizon DBIR on the Sierra mailing list. And, you know, I think the problem has largely been solved. I guess the question is whether or not people view the Verisk community as adequately independent. And I suspect the answer is no. But, you know, I think we've got the makings already of that. But in my mind, we have to solve this problem. You know, the paper, in my mind, puts forth some really astute observations that I've also had and I think lots of others had. And so it's really worth a read. It's, you know, unfortunately about 48 pages long. But, you know, I don't think you need to read everything to get the gist of it. But anyway, I really feel pretty strongly that as an industry, we've got to get our arms around this from the perspective of knowing where we stand. Are we getting better? How is our organization doing relative to other organizations? What should we be spending to, you know, protect our environment, relative to our risk, and kind of viewing it again more from a financial risk standpoint? Because again, security is very much like an insurance policy, and what we're missing is the context of knowing whether we have the right size insurance policy or not. And I think this is one of the keys to getting there.
I agree on all counts.
All right, rant off.
And for the record, too long, didn't read.
Fair enough.
I skimmed. But yeah, this is an area that you definitely have more passion and knowledge about than I do. So I say, rant on, Jerry.
This is something that I'm acutely interested in, the quantification of security and looking at security from a actuarial perspective. So anyway,
and let me tell you, folks, Jerry is a hit at parties.
Oh yeah.
The mob scene.
Jeez. All right. So, moving on. The next story comes from Computer World. And the title is "The Best Data Security Offense is a Good Defense." And I really think this is a horrible title for this article.
But it's clickbait.
But it is clickbait. And I included it because I thought it was worth talking about, obviously.
Hey, fair warning, by the way. To read the full thing, you've got to register, and it's free, but you have to log in and register.
Good point.
Just saying.
I definitely would not recommend changing your browser user agent string to be Googlebot. That would be terrible, unethical, inappropriate to get around that kind of thing. I don't advise it.
I would concur. That's completely ill-advised.
It's a bad idea. Don't do it. So anyway.
Can you ask Bob about that for me?
Sure. I'll talk to him about that. This is actually a 4-page article, and to sum it up, right, it's a story about this head of an IT department at the Pennsylvania Department of Public Welfare. And this lady named Pamela Skelton took over the reins and, characterized what she walked into as a bit of a compliance mess. And apparently she has quite a few different compliance regimes she's got to comply with, which I think a lot of us do. I think that was played up a little bit too much. But I think this was the right way to solve the problem. You know, it's kind of the whole making lemonade out of lemons, right? I'm definitely not in the camp that compliance equals security. I mean, there's nobody should really have any misconception about that. So the point is that we still have to do it. Whether or not we like it, we've got to live with it. And so you may as well try to optimize it. And so the point of this story is how this lady optimized the process of complying with different regulations in her organization and how it worked out for her. You know, essentially what she did was she assigned a couple of people for the better part of a year to go through all of the different regulations and consolidate them down into unique controls. And then they picked, you know, where there are overlapping controls, they picked the most stringent among them. And that's what they deployed throughout their organization. And they implemented a GRC solution that allowed them to do kind of, point and click compliance reports and all that happy crap. But it's a good idea if you can get there, because it lets you focus on things that are important rather than kind of the audit rat race, so to speak. So anyway, I thought this was an interesting article. It's kind of off the path of what I normally like to talk about, but you know, here it is.
Cool. Fair enough. And I know the last two I just don't have a lot to say on, so I'm not gonna just kill airtime.
It's all good. The last thing we're gonna talk about is the attack of the week.
And dun dun dun.
Dun dun dun. And for this week, we picked defacements. And this is kind of big news lately, especially with the Syrian Electronic Army and other related players. So let us begin.
Defacements. You know, this was like, you know, back in the day, the big thing, right? This was the trophy you would go after is deface a website with your hacker brand and, you know, get it added to the archives.
Get yourself on Zone H.
That's right. And, you know, a few other, what was the other big archive one? Come on, am I suddenly blanking?
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking
about. Oh, I can't believe I'm blanking. Everybody's probably yelling at their podcast machine right now. I'll think of it in a second. Anyway, you know, doing the defacement and then getting, you know, live captures of it noticed by other people was always the thing. But nowadays, things have changed a bit. Things have changed a bit. So, you know, a web defacement, is that really an attack, or is that more of a, you know, the results of an attack, though? Because a web defacement could happen a lot of different ways.
Well, and I think that's the key, right, is that it can happen in lots of different ways, and it does happen in many spectacular ways. And so, you know, I thought it would be useful to talk about, you know, again, because, again, it can happen in lots of different ways. So I kind of was going to run through those, and then we could talk about some of the things we might do to prevent and detect that from happening.
Indeed.
So the first thing is, if you host your system in a share, or your website in a shared hosting environment, what often happens, and we see this a lot with Anonymous, you know, what Anonymous will do when they announce one of their one of their wonderful operations.
They're coming after us now.
I hedge my bets there. Did you see that? What they'll often do, and you know, whether this is actually a result of the operation or whether this is just coincidental, I have my own feelings on that. A lot of times they'll hit a shared server, and if the shared server is set up, you know, not really strongly, if you can compromise one account either with a weak password or a WordPress vulnerability, or, you know, God knows there's enough of those, you can potentially deface hundreds of websites with one fell swoop. And I think there's even some scripts out there that will iterate through all of the subdirectories and all of the accounts and basically auto deface.
Which, hey, you know, good bang for your buck if they're the defacer.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So that's one.
Wait. I got to pop in here.
All right.
So you brought up Anonymous. I'm going to derail the conversation for just a moment. I have to say this. So I often see a lot of vendor prezos, and I'm not going to say who. I'm not going to pick on a specific vendor. But if your vendor prezo that you're using to pitch your product or service uses the Guy Fawkes mask on the front page or anywhere in it, you lose. Sorry,
Was someone trying to sell you the Anon Guard 2000?
But it was probably an 18, you know, slide deck, and the Anonymous. Well, I shouldn't say the Anonymous. The Guy Fawkes mask, which has now been popularized by Anonymous after V for Vendetta, was on six of those slides.
Nice. That's awesome.
And it drove me I had to wrap my head in duct tape to keep it from exploding.
But, you know, I got to tell you, internally, I think a lot of organizations have gotten a lot of mileage out of FUD, you know, with presentations, including Guy Fawkes masks.
Well, whenever I go do my reviews with my boss, I wear one. It seems to work.
Yeah, good.
Yeah,
and HR, if it goes well, it's you. If it doesn't go well, it's somebody else, right?
Anyway, so and go ahead. I've also got some notes here I'll throw into the discussion.
Sure,
You might cover them, so carry on.
Okay. The next item is abandoned and unmaintained sections of the website. And we've seen this in some pretty high-profile, not only defacements, but actual pretty significant compromises, not the least of which was DigiNotar, you know, which was just a spectacular flaming hole in the ground now, where you know, their main website had a subdomain or a subdirectory that had a content management system that had essentially been abandoned, and someone stumbled on that and used a well-known exploit, and they wormed their way into the environment, and now that company's out of business. So that's one. I'm a big proponent of making sure you've got an owner tagged very clearly to anything like that. And you know, as those people move around in the organization, you've got to have that ownership passed on to somebody else. The next is weak passwords. So especially on publicly accessible sites, you know, we see weak passwords being used. Not, for example, well, actually, I'm going to come back to that in a minute. The reused passwords is what I was thinking of. So we saw, for instance, in the you know, the most recently the Adobe breach, lots of passwords being disclosed, and it's unclear whether it's related. However, I'm a little suspicious. The Mac Rumors website had its wasn't defaced, but it could have been. Their password list of 800 and some thousand entries was stolen when an attacker found a password for an administrator account that was in another password dump.
Nice.
So, yeah, strong passwords and unique passwords, people.
Very perhaps important. Even two-factor.
Or even better, two-factor.
Or even, I don't know, if that's if two's good, then eight-factor is better.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, hey, why stop there? The next is phishing. And so we have seen the Syrian Electronic Army be an absolute machine in this area, right? Most recently, they went after Vice.com. I don't know if you happen to see that, but Vice got defaced, which was interesting because there was a kind of a tit-for-tat fight between the Syrian Electronic Army and Vice.com when Vice tried to dox some of the SEA members a couple of months ago, and then
nice.
The SEA shook their fist at him and said, "We're coming after you." And, you know, so anyway, the SEA's got a very common and calculated MO where basically they fish their way to the credentials to manage the website or the Twitter feed or whatever it is. You know, they are masters at this. So they'll go after, you know, they'll go after the server administrators, they'll go after the web designers, whatever, whoever they can find that has credentials on the site they're trying to deface. You know, it is it's pretty amazing. So I think you have to make sure that phishing is on the radar when you think about how you're going to defend your web properties. Next is DNS takeovers. And we've seen that also have a, you know, happen through the Syrian Electronic Army's normal phishing attack. But there's, you know, there's other less spectacular ways, including, you know, fake faxes and you know, lots of other kind of low tech ways, you know, where if you can hijack the DNS records of a domain, you don't have to break into the server. You don't have to steal a password. You just have to point it to a server you control. And now you can put whatever the heck you want on that site. And then that's what I got. What do you have?
So you definitely grab some of the couple that I had jotted down here. One method that we often see is a SQL injection leading to owning the box. Is one that you didn't mention that we see pretty often. And that happens a lot, especially with badly written code, when the code is just not watching for any sort of balance checking, it's not doing any sort of input validation, and it's really easy to do SQL injection or cross-site scripting or similar attacks. We're seeing folks still go after FTP. Believe it or not, FTP is still used to move website material around a lot, and it's fairly easy to brute force your way through, depending on what kind of passwords are being used and how automated it is. And so we see some people use FTP as an attack vector. You mentioned the CMS, content management systems, another big area where people can go after if they can, pop the CMS or if there's a known vulnerability. So definitely keep those up to date. Keep an eye on those. WordPress, which I wouldn't necessarily, immediately lump into CMS, but similar plugins like WordPress are notorious for being widely deployed. And when an exploit is found, massive amounts of automated attacks across all the WordPress can happen very quickly. So that's one thing, too, that it's good to know what you're running on your website, what sort of plugins, what sort of infrastructure, what sort of code, and monitoring those specific organizations or whatever methodology you do to monitor, make sure you know when patches come out and exploits are running in the wild. Definitely good to know. The other thing that I want to bring up too was some of the defacements aren't very obvious. Sometimes it can be used to insert a very small iframe, which could have some other very malicious content and could be used for a watering hole attack. So that's one thing to keep in mind as well, is that it may not be obvious. So it could end up, with a website being defaced, could end up being an attack launching point to infect a lot more things. And now you've gone from a reputation hit of having your website hacked to a reputation hit of you have now infected a lot of your customers with something bad, which is even worse.
Yeah, and we've seen that. We've seen that with, we just talked about crack.com. That's exactly what happened to them, and php.net a couple weeks ago. And, on and on. The list is long and distinguished of companies that's happened to. And you're right. It is often extremely difficult to detect, because a lot of times these things are actually, I'd say most of the time, they're very cleverly obscured, right?
Yeah.
So you can't just pull up the file and say, oh, look at that. It's, they do a really good job generally of obfuscating the code.
And yeah, it depends on their goal, right? If they're just trying to make a political statement, it's going to be very obvious.
Yeah,
exactly. They've replaced index.html with "Fear my elite skills, dude." Right? That's pretty obvious. So my, some advice that I came up with is some architectural stuff. Make sure you've got good, secure, safe backups. Make sure that, your content is not only in one spot. Don't trust that's always going to be valid. And make sure that you can get those backups, back onto your site quickly. Practice this sort of thing. Really, your goal with the defacement is, once you have done everything you can to stop the various vectors that we've talked about, is then assume that it might still happen. Then it comes down to finding it very quickly, understanding it happened as soon as you possibly can, and mitigating it. That might be just turning the website off. That might be redirecting DNS. That might be getting the website, whatever it needs to be. You want to get that defacement down as quickly as you can for most organizations, right? That's an individual decision, but that's, the common advice. And there are services out there. There are third-party services that will do just website monitoring to indicate whenever a change is noticed in any of your HTML code and alert you, which is not a bad idea. And they'll do it from multiple spots on the internet. There's internal tools like Nagios is a well-known freeware. I think it's commercial now. infrastructure monitoring tool. It has specific plugins for monitoring for website defacement and hijacking. So, you know, there are tools you can set up. The other thing I'd recommend is regular third-party audits of your web infrastructure, both from a security architecture review, vulnerability assessments, perhaps even pen testing, though one of these days we'll have to talk about pen testing and how to use that tool properly. But a third party, a good third party, you get what you pay for. And full disclosure, I work for a company that does this, but can find things that you're not seeing due to tunnel vision and can point out things that you may be overlooking because that's just the way we've always done it here and can expose a lot of issues before the bad guys do. I'd much rather have a consultancy pointed out to me a nice little happy report with pretty pictures and arrows and letters and a paragraph description than the bad guys finding it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, one thing that is, yeah, I know we're bleeding into the conversation on pen testing, but I see a lot of people not wanting to do a pen test because it could disrupt their infrastructure. And I think that's to an extent kind of bunk because, you know, in a pen test environment or engagement, it all happens on your time and on your schedule. And
you're, you know, gonna get me on my soapbox, man.
I know. We'll come back to that one.
Yeah, because that's a big topic.
I wanted to circle back to something that you mentioned about shortening the time to detection. I think that's really important, and I also think it's important to plan ahead about what you'll do if something happens, so that you're not making it up. You're not figuring out, hey, we'll throw up a maintenance page or we'll redirect DNS somewhere else. You know, have that thought out ahead and so that it maybe practice it, right? So it's somewhat mechanical and you can react quickly. And I think there are as many different ways to detect when something has gone awry as there are, you know, people willing to code something up. There, as you mentioned, there's a lot of commercial and open source packages, but you know, something as simple as a tripwire or something like that would do the job. You know, there are a lot of open source scripts that do the same thing. You know, learn from what PHP had, right? Google told them that their site was serving malware.
What does Google know?
And they didn't believe it. You know, if Google tells you that your site's serving malware, you probably should pay attention to it. And, you know,
there's a good chance you're serving malware.
There's a good chance you're serving malware. They tend to know what they're talking about. You know, but again, I would say the contra is not also true. You know, if you suspect something's happening and Google is saying your site's clean, I wouldn't take that as, you know, as anything, because a lot of these kits are now becoming really aware of the different crawlers and bots, and they will not serve malicious content to, for instance, Google based on their IP or their user agent string, that sort of thing. So, you know, that's there's a lot of different opportunities to detect this kind of thing. I really think that the tripwire style model, maybe not tripwire itself, but the tripwire style model is quite effective. I've seen that used very effectively. It tends to be the thing that will most quickly alert you to a problem on your site. And, you know, use it. It's not hard to set up.
If anyone from Tripwire would like to sponsor our show, Jerry and I can be bought.
There you go.
Bandwidth is not free.
No, it is not.
But no, I agree with you. But and, you know, this is such a huge topic. I feel like we're just scratching the surface of this one. There's a lot you could talk about, but hopefully this has been useful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think we're going to cut it off there. I, as usual, appreciate everyone listening. It is always nice to see positive feedback. And in that vein, if you like the show, if you find it useful, you know, give us a good rating in iTunes. We'd appreciate it. And if you have any ideas or thoughts, send us an email to info@defensivesecurity.org. I'm very happy to converse with whoever sends an email. And I've had a lot of great conversations with listeners in the past. You can hit us up on Twitter. The Twitter account for the podcast is @DefensiveSec. My Twitter ID is @MaliciousLink. Mr. Kalitz is @Lurg. You can find the show on the internet at www.defensivesecurity.org. And I've got the show notes and lots of other fun stuff listed up there. And with that, I think we'll call it a week. Have a great one.
Take care. See you guys.
See ya. Bye.